In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
The following podcast has some fruity language. Sorry, my bad. So take care of who's listening around you. Nau mai hoki mai to It's Personal with me, Anika Moore. This is a podcast where I get personal with very, very interesting people.
Especially if, if you're... if you've just met someone and you're like...
You're on a date. Sorry, I just got to poke myself.
Yeah, I do, and you do. I do in a restaurant. I don't go into the toilet.
Neither
do I. I just whack up my shirt.
And I've got a fat gut turn. I'm like,
I just do it.
Here it is.
One time a guy asked me whether I was shooting heroin.
Okay, my guest this week is journalist Guyon Espinar. He has diabetes just like me. So we'll chat about that, but also interviewing and imagination. Firstly, I'm just going to say I'm quite intimidated to interview you because you're an interviewer also. It's like your profession.
Yeah.
Do you like interviewing people?
I love interviewing people. Yeah, I love interviewing people. It's so much more than just a list of questions, isn't it? You're thinking about how am I going to tell this person's story and... So I love that about interviewing, and I love the surprises, and I love the connection with people.
Do you, growing up, were you inquisitive, like in your whānau? Were you always the talker, show off?
Well, not really, because I was the youngest of three boys, but the older two were pretty loud and did their thing. But my dad used to kind of host these dinner table debates, so it was quite sort of serious. Like he had a topic of conversation. It'd be about politics or the Springbok tour or anti-nuclear movement or something. Oh, probably from the age of 8, 9, 10, certainly through those years and a bit older. And that's where I sort of developed this interest in politics and I guess the media. And just stuff that was going on in the world. But this sort of scenario was you had to have your facts straight. You'd get challenged on what you were doing.
By your dad?
Yeah, pretty much.
What about your mum? Would she just be cooking going, oh dear?
She wasn't engaged to the same level that he was and would get a bit frustrated at times. I think she wanted a bit more peace and quiet than an organised debate over dinner. But certainly that was probably the sort of, the kindling of it.
Why do you think that your dad did that? Why do you think he was he trying to install free thinking, or did he have a set of thinking? Was he, national? Was he Labour? How do you think his mind worked? Because I know he was an
He's an endocrinologist, and we'll probably talk about endocrinology because we both need them.
Yeah.
so that's one of the ironies that my dad's an endocrinologist. Now he's pretty liberal. He gets more left wing by the year, I think, and he's 90, so he's he's out there on the trajectory now. But no, there wasn't any political activism on his behalf. He just wanted us to engage and debate and talk about the world, you know. And I think because he'd worked a lot and was really busy and didn't engage with us for some of that time, the dinner time in those days was the time where you had your kōrero, you had your wānanga, basically.
I love that.
Yeah, it's cool.
So you're this young boy, you're going to school. What's your dream when you're at school? What do you dream of doing? Are you dreaming of being an All Black, being an endocrinologist? How do you say it?
It's a hard one to say, isn't it?
Endocrinology.
Yeah.
Endocrinology. Yeah. You want to follow in your dad's footsteps. What's in your brain at school? And are you a high achiever?
Not really, no. Sport was a huge thing for me, and it was cricket and soccer for me in those days.
Yeah.
But then my first big memory of what my future might look like, we had a short story writing competition. I was 15, and I still remember the English teacher, who's pretty, she was pretty hard-ass. We were all a bit scared of her, and she we'd all had to write these short stories, and she slammed mine down on the desk and said, "You could be a writer," she said to me. And I was like, and I never forgotten that. I was 15, and I've made my living, and my whole career has been based on writing. I still am a writer, whether it's writing for radio or television, yeah, or a book or a script or whatever. And I am a writer, and I place a lot of that back to that point where someone said to me, "I've got faith in you, you could do this," and someone you respected and trusted their judgment.
Yeah.
And so from quite an early age, you know, mid-teens, I was going to be a writer. At first that was going to be, you know, I was going to be the next Stephen King or something.
Oh, so fiction.
Well, I was hoping, you know, who knows. But eventually that rolled into journalism. And
how does it roll into journalism from horror, Stephen King, to politics and journalism?
Oh, we make it all up, don't you know that?
What, journalists? Or?
We're bribed. No, I suppose, especially in long feature writing, you use those same sort of narrative techniques as you do in storytelling. It's all storytelling, eh? One of them, you just got to prove it.
So you go from fiction to journalism. How do you end up in journalism as a young man? Was it, were you chasing a girl into the beehive? Were you...
I was probably more chasing my brother. My oldest brother was a journalist before me. And I'd done this English literature degree at Canterbury University. I'd studied poetry. Poets didn't get paid much. I decided that I'd go into journalism. And, I'd spent the summer sort of doing, voluntary work at the local community newspaper. And I still do remember getting my byline published for the first time. This probably speaks to my ego.
What's
and
a byline?
By so-and-so, by a guy in this little community newspaper. It was about kangaroo meat or something. I don't know what the story was. But just sort of seeing my work and my name, it was a bit of an ego boost. I just remember being very excited about that. And it just went from there.
And how old were you when you got into... was politics first day?
Yeah, well, I was doing more general journalism. I mean, I graduated in 93, 94, sort of, it was really high unemployment, so you sent your CV all around the country. I went on job trials on papers in Oamaru in Auckland. I was from Christchurch. Finally ended up in the Levin Chronicle in Ōtaki as a sub-editor and travelled around. So it was a couple of years before I got a really good gig at a newspaper. And, and then they set me up to the press gallery and I started reporting on politics from about 1998.
Wow.
And I spent 14, 15 years in the press gallery reporting on politics.
And how was that for you? Like, what was your first... Were you interviewing people back then?
I was reporting for a newspaper, so yeah, okay. Some interviewing, but not like we're doing, not long-form interviewing, more just finding stories and writing them up and things like that. So, yeah, just after I started... Winston Peters collapsed the first MMP government. He was in government with National. The whole thing blew up halfway through the term, and it was just so exciting. Like the whole country was like focused on on Parliament, and it was just so invigorating. I guess that I just became quite obsessed and addicted to politics. It's a bit like a soap opera, you know. How's the next bit going to unfurl, and how's the next bit going to? What's the next bit of the story? And so I went right through to TVNZ for nearly a decade, and ended up 15 years in politics
on the TV, doing all the interviews.
Largely.
Why does Winston Peters pop up all the time? Why is he? How is he still here? What do you think? Do you know him personally?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do.
And what do you think? How do you think his brain ticks?
I think he's driven by revenge.
Why? Who's he got revenge on?
Anyone who's crossed him in the past.
Okay.
He's such a survivor, and he's so incredibly strategically smart about how to play his hand. You know, you wouldn't want to play poker against him. He's utterly dominated MMP pretty much every election since the system came in, and continues to do so. It's quite incredible.
But he's such a douchebag.
He's very, very good as a politician, though. I would go as far as to say is you won't see a more successful politician, even internationally in a democracy. Yeah. I mean, he's chosen, you know, 4 or 5 prime ministers. It's the extent of the influence is extraordinary. And you do that with 5, 6, 7% of the vote. It's amazing how he's leveraged his hand. It's quite phenomenal.
Do you look up to that, or
I respect that. I share some of your frustrations. Wouldn't use quite the same language, but you know, I can see how for the 94% of people who didn't vote for him, they may have ideas that he's you know, taken more than his fair share of the power. Mm-hmm. It is a pretty extraordinary way to conduct yourself.
So what do you think your interviewing style is? How do you approach an interview? So if you're to interview me, how would you go about it? Or is every person different?
They are different. I mean, I have sort of combatants and non-combatants, you know, like, so if you're a combatant, like as a politician, I'll have a different strategy and a different desire for the outcome than a non-combatant.
Okay. Do you always get your desired outcome with an interviewee?
Oh, no.
Who's the most frustrating person to interview?
The guy we were just talking about.
Really?
Yeah, he's incredibly difficult to interview because he'll attack you and he'll start interviewing you. And so you get into this whole sort of Jedi Knight, sort of the Force sort of situation where you're trying to wrestle back control of the interview. So he's very difficult to interview.
Anyone else? David Seymour? Jacinda?
Yeah, I mean, David Seymour is a pretty good, challenging interview. I liked a lot about Jacinda Ardern and knew her a little bit before she was in that role, and I got a lot of respect for her, but she wasn't a very rewarding interview.
Why?
Because she didn't reveal much and she didn't want to get away from her... She had a very defensive attitude. It seemed to me as though a win for her would be not to tell you anything. Like, she'd get through 7 minutes on Morning Report without actually revealing anything to the listener. And so that was very frustrating. And, she just didn't really...
Don't all politicians do that?
Well, though? I found Clark and Key, for example, quite different like that, that they would usually give you something quite newsworthy or give you their point of view.
Okay.
Even under sufferance. Whereas she would use a blizzard of words, none of which would really add much to... your understanding of what was going on. She seemed incredibly defensive about that the aim was not to tell you anything, which...
But you had to interview her because that was your job, right?
Yeah, and also they do, you know, prime ministers do these weekly media slots, and, yeah, sure, you want to have the opportunity to interview the prime minister, but it wasn't so rewarding.
I was working for The Hits, and we'd interview her once a week, and we'd just talk about being pregnant, her baby, Clark, what she ate for dinner. Like, it was...
Well, you probably got more out of her than
I
did.
We got lots out of her. Because, you know, we're not talking politics with her.
Yeah.
I wanted to, but you can't do that when you're working for a radio station like that.
No.
Do you think you're an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm an introvert until the red light goes on.
And then you're like a peacock.
Well, I think I'm someone who can put the uniform on. You know, it's funny when you talk to people and you're in the media a lot, and then they get to know you, or they're surprised that you're actually quite introverted. I'm a relatively shy person at times, but I'm someone who knows that part of our job is to put the uniform on and do it. And if I'm going to go down the barrel of the camera, then I'm going to go down the barrel of the camera. You know, and that's fine for me because I've learned to do that. In the same way that I imagine that firefighters, you know, climb up ladders into burning buildings.
You do your job.
Yeah, you do your job. And I've very much found that about journalism, that if you believe strongly in what you're doing, then that will carry you through those times of anxiety, so you don't go, oh my God, I'm interviewing Hillary Clinton, or I'm interviewing the Prime Minister, and I'm hungover, or whatever the case might be.
How do you interview when you're hungover? No, how do you interview when you're hungover? Because I know that you used to be a
No, I was a big drinker.
Yeah, yeah, heavy drinker.
Let's not mess around.
It was
the bush,
normal.
Yeah. Oh,
it was
yeah, totally.
Normal.
Yeah, totally. Oh,
and
I
you'd
had
interview
some
when you were hungover.
Oh,
what
yeah,
do you
some
do?
Shockers.
Are you shaking?
Oh.
Are you wanting to vomit in the bush?
Yeah, I remember one time interviewing Helen Clark on this show that no one remember called Agenda, and it ran at like 8:30 on a Saturday morning.
Helen Clark.
And it had been the Labor Party conference or something, and all the journos had got together the night before, and I'd had this massive binge, basically. And I remember being woken up in the hotel by the 17th phone call from the producer saying, you've got to get in here now, you know, this interview starts in like 20 minutes, and getting sort of barreled in and made up, but and going into the studio and ensuring that Helen Clark, could have, who's pretty abstemious, would smell me reeking of alcohol. But I actually got through that interview. There was a few close calls like that.
Yeah. Okay. So you, what's been your best interview? Like, who do you find pleasure in interviewing? That sounds weird, but you know what I mean? Like, it excites you to interview people.
Yeah. I guess they probably do fall into those categories of the politicians where you're going up against them. And, you know, Winston Peters, as we talked about, but Michael Cullen, Helen Clark, those kinds of figures. Mm-hmm. That's pretty rewarding in its own way. But I don't know, sometimes it's people who are more vulnerable and who go into that non-combatants category that I talked about. I did a series of stories on Auckland Women's Prison and how people were treated there. And, you know, some of those stories were pretty moving and pretty, you know, you've got a bigger duty of care with people like that. And so I find those pretty rewarding too. Very different from the political interviews. Yeah.
Do you like being interviewed? And do you feel like you can be vulnerable with people?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I probably set myself up now, haven't I?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Because I want to know, like, what Guyon is like as a person at home. Like, do you talk to yourself in the shower? What movies do you watch? Like, what kind of person are you away from politics?
I do talk to myself a bit.
Do you?
I probably am quite a reflective person.
A worrywart? Is that part of reflecting?
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Your body language is
very... I probably am reflective and cautious in that way. I'm a long distance runner. I think a lot, but yeah, I'm probably fairly ordinary in most respects. You know, I watch movies, read books, play music
in an introverted way.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm one of these people who likes a smaller group of really close friends rather than just, you know, being, I'm not super social, you know.
Have a little quiet,
yeah,
whānau
like
group where you're just like, you trust them,
yeah.
They trust you.
Yeah, I am a bit like that. I do find it quite hard to make new friends and get to know people.
Why?
I'm probably a little bit standoffish, aren't I, you know.
What's aloof?
Maybe that's the. It's hard to know, isn't it, how people perceive you, you know? You'd be the same, like, and especially if you're a little bit in the public eye, people will construct a perception around you. Like, people associate me with politics, and they see me as quite a serious person.
Well, that's why I'm trying to wonder if you have jokes, if you tell yourself jokes, or you tell your daughter jokes. I was talking about this with Susie Cato last night because I had she bought me a Jell-O shot. And I was like, Susie Cato's bought me a Jell-O shot. You're Susie Cato. And she was like, yeah, well, everyone thinks I'm just this lovely, you know, TV presenter. And people probably think you're a little bit naughty and cheeky and a bit of a rebel. And I'm like, yeah, they do. But I'm actually really serious. And I'm an introvert too. And she's like, well, I like a couple of drinks. And I like to sing. And I am naughty too. You know, it's like, oh, it's that whole perception. So what, because I do find you quite standoffish, but I know you because we've hung out, we've had coffee, we've talked. I've absolutely rattled your brain with all my diabetes questions.
But when we've talked about those things, we've talked about them pretty openly and with a lot of laughs over, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, totally. You know, it just, if I let people in, they'll get to see that. But I suppose, like, my outside veneer is maybe a little bit like that. Yeah.
Let's move on to diabetes because you're, you know, a young, fit male, and then all of a sudden you develop type 1 diabetes at the age of what?
47, I think it was. Yeah, 47, 48. It was 2018. I would have been 48, wouldn't I? Yeah.
What were your symptoms?
Just the classic, an utter, like a desert-like thirst.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't drunk for 40 days. I remember reading my daughter, Nico, bedtime stories, which I always do, even to this day. I still read and make them up nowadays. And I could barely get the words out. And because I was so thirsty. And it's this incredible, incredible thirst for someone who hasn't had it. Like, literally, like you have just been walking through the Sahara for days. So I had that. And I lost a lot of weight. And I was like, this is unusual. And also, you are pissing all the time. Mm-hmm. Sorry, excuse my language, but you are just pissing.
Mimi, you're basically, you and the toilet are best friends.
Yeah, it's just, so something strange going on. And my dad, who discussed previously, is an endocrinologist. my wife at the time, who was training to be a doctor, neither of them picked it up. Like, it was the symptoms were your classic ones: weight loss, blurry vision, excessive urination, or lots of meme, and weight loss. My dad said, "Oh, just, you know, just drink more beer and eat more chips, you'll be fine."
Is it because you're a 48-year-old white
probably
male?
Yeah, and people associate, but this is weird from an endocrinologist.
Yes.
But people associate, and I did, associated diabetes, because I didn't know anything about it, with being overweight.
Mm-hmm. Brown.
Yeah, possibly. I just didn't know enough about it, and so didn't think this was my profile.
So did you end up in hospital with DKA?
I did. I went to the doctor, he said, "I'll just get you to take this test." And so I went into this room with a nurse who just pricked my finger, and she went down on the thing, and she went, and I'll never forget it. She went, "Oh my God, are you diabetic?" Because people don't need to know the numbers and technicalities, but roughly I should have been at 5 millimol, doesn't matter what that stands for, and I was at 25. And so I was 5 times the, you know, the safe zone, if you like. And there was no argument. He basically just said, "Yeah, you need to go to hospital now." And I was going into DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis.
So what's DKA, just for people who are interested in that?
DKA is the most common presentation of type 1 diabetes, really. Diabetic ketoacidosis. Basically, for people with a normal functioning pancreas, the insulin will take the food and the carbohydrate and the sugars that you've ingested, and they'll put that into the cells. But for diabetics with no insulin, the sugar and carbohydrate goes straight into the blood. Your blood will effectively become acidic and poisonous, and that'll collapse your body and kill you in relatively short order. Yeah, and you and I, if we were trapped in a shed out in the wilderness with no insulin, we'd be in deep trouble in a day or two. I know I would be.
Yeah, yeah.
And we probably wouldn't last a week or two. Yeah, that was a huge shock for me, because I went from, I don't know what's wrong with me, this is kind of weird, to a couple of hours later being in hospital and with 3 drips in my arm.
But surely, because when I went into DKA and I found out I had type 1 diabetes, I had to call an ambulance because I had a pain in my side. Mm. I couldn't walk. I'd spent a whole week with swollen knees and I was nearly dead. Like, surely before you went to the doctors, you were feeling all those. I mean, are they the same? Are we the same?
Well, we are the same. But Maybe I caught it earlier, or I don't know. I'd gone to work that morning. I'd gone and done, and I remember because it's Māori Language Week, and I was it's at a time where I was really trying to use my reo on the radio, and yeah. and it was Māori Language Week, and that was so important to me. I just interviewed the Prime Minister, had this GP appointment, I still remember it, and then the next thing I know, I was in hospital. Yeah. Other people said that they'd see me on that day and around that time, and I looked terrible. Like my skin was starting to go yellow, and I was losing. Yeah, and it wasn't just hey, I've lost weight. It was like you know you can sort of see your body's it's eating itself effectively.
I know. Hey. I felt the same way. Yeah. I was so gaunt. I'd lost like 35 kgs, and I actually looked at photos of me yesterday. I looked like my skin was hanging off me.
Yeah.
But everyone was saying, "Oh, you're looking good." And
yeah.
I was like, "Oh fuck,
yeah.
this is cool." But yeah. I was dying.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you're in hospital. And then they're like, okay, you got type 1 diabetes. What do you do? Like, are you crying?
Do you know, I made a pact with myself not to, and I only broke it once. I made a pact with myself not to cry about it. And I'm a bit of a crier. Like, I will cry. Mm. And I made a pact with myself not to feel sorry for myself because it's a lifelong
thing. That was my
next question. You can't cure it, ever. So you have to inject insulin at least 5 times a day, mm-hmm. sometimes more, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And there's no holiday, as you know. And so if you're going to go down the self-pity track, this is what I was telling myself, yeah. literally telling myself, then that is just a rabbit hole you are never going to come out of. And I did break it one time, but other than that, I've still got that attitude. Oh, I had one of those continuous glucose monitors, CGMs mm-hmm. they call them, and you stick them, whack them into your arm. It's a bit painful. I don't know if you've got one on at the moment. But
I ran out of money.
Yeah, they're expensive,
They're expensive.
Yeah, and I had that in at the time quite quickly. I don't use one now,
yep.
partly for that reason. It's expensive,
it's
and
expensive.
They're not paid for.
Yep.
It wasn't working, and I was trying to drive out to the North Shore to get this thing looked at by someone, and I was trying to then test my blood sugars at the same time because I was really scared that I was going too low or too high, and I was driving, and I just started crying. I was just like felt sorry for myself and let that go, and it was like quite a big thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, I've pretty much kept to that pact, which is, you know... this is not something that you can wish didn't happen because there's no way out of it.
Did you even once since you've had diabetes say, why me? Because I've had lots of why me moments and wished it away. And I made a pact with myself to always cry because it's okay. It's okay if you've got an autoimmune disease that there's no cure for.
Yeah, and maybe,
I mean, is that your personality shining
probably
through?
Is.
Like, get on with it, come on.
Pretty much.
YOLO.
Yeah, I guess so. Mm. Yeah, and maybe I don't let myself go in that vulnerability enough, mm-hmm. maybe. And
there's no wrong or right
way
to feel about, because type 1 diabetes, usually kids are diagnosed with it. And you go, why now? Why is this happening at such a late time in my life? Have I done something? Like, is it because we've done something? Why has the Lord forsaken us? You know, like...
Yeah, I said to myself, it's not a justice system, it's a health system.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's no justice in it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are always people worse off than you. I mean, I thought it might have been my boozing for a while, but they don't know what causes it.
So do you think that we could have had it as children and it just never presented itself until... because we just got on with it?
I think the most likely thing, from what I've read, is that you have a predisposition towards it from some genetic thing, so you're more likely to get it, and then it's a virus possibly is the trigger, but mm-hmm. We don't know, right? We really don't. So it's still a bit of a mystery.
Do you are you sick of having to explain to people what your diabetes is all about? Because you do, eh? You go out.
Yeah, you do. And especially if you meet someone, mm-hmm. you know, especially if, you know, if you're, if you've just met someone and you're like...
You're on a date. Sorry,
yeah.
I just got to poke myself.
Yeah, I do. And you do. And I do, I do, I, I do in a restaurant. I don't go into the toilet.
Never
die. I just whack up my shirt.
And I've got a fat gut turn. I'm like, oh,
yeah, yeah, just do it.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Is my insulin.
Yeah. One time a guy asked me whether I was shooting heroin. He said, is that heroin?
Were you like, would you like some?
Yeah, they come in these Pfizer things now.
What is it
like? Sanofi.
What is it like? Because you're single, right?
Yeah, I've got a girlfriend at the moment.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're dating, you know, when you do date.
Yeah.
And you are doing all that. Is it awkward?
Yeah.
Really? Like, are they like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also it's a hard condition to manage, isn't it? Because there are so many things that impact on it. The time of the meal that you're eating. You could eat, for me, in my experience, you could eat a meal at 6 o'clock, eat exactly the same meal at 8 o'clock, and the 8 o'clock meal means you're going to have far higher blood sugars the next morning than the 6 o'clock meal.
Yeah,
and so everything from the time that you took your insulin to when you're having your meal, and then how do you dose? Like for people who don't know about type 1, you're taking usually taking a long-acting one which buzzes around in the background, but then you're taking a rapid-acting dose of insulin for every meal. So you've got to go, how many carbohydrates are in this meal, roughly? And then dial your dose up to make sure that there's enough insulin to cover that meal. So how do you dose for a snack evening? Like, oh, why don't we just have snacks tonight? So that people are eating over 2 hours and that's great. But you can't dose for that as a diabetic.
You can't. It
doesn't work. You know, you'd be dosing tiny amounts like 4 times at the night.
Yeah,
so it just doesn't work. So all of that social stuff, sometimes you just got to wear it and you know your numbers are going to be a bit out. Because you just can't change the social situation. Other times you run into real trouble. Like, I know for me, if I inject rapid-acting insulin and quite soon after that even go for a walk, I'll plunge down to dangerous levels.
Yeah.
So what do? You're at a beach barbecue. You don't not go along, you know. You have a bit of a feed. You've had your insulin and then suddenly everyone wants to play volleyball or go for a swim or go walk up that Maunga there. Well, what do? And so it's all of the social stuff. I mean, if you were just, I remember in lockdown it was easy because you just had your meals, you were at home, you did your thing.
Had your routine
and it was quite easy to control it. But once you put that out in the wild with social situations and, why don't we just go and grab some fish and chips?
So how do you control it though? Because I know you and I know you've got a routine and you stay at 5 millimoles and you have, you know, the banana 20 minutes before you run. So are you absolutely meticulous?
I'm pretty meticulous, yeah. And sometimes I just, like if I go to a big awards night or something in journalism and there's a meal, I just will eat before I go and then just pretend. So
no.
I get the big proper steak and then I just pretend that I've eaten it and just leave it aside, yeah. So
see,
I do sacrifice
steak,
a bit.
I'll eat that steak and I'll just be like, oh, well, gut, fat gut. Sweet as.
Yeah, I'm getting a little looser, but it goes to personality. You've constructed this interview well because you've set up the fact that I am I'm quite a sort of constrained, sort of
standoffish, quiet introvert.
Not a very pleasant person, yeah.
No. You and I know well you are very pleasant.
Thank you.
I think you're really handsome.
Thank you.
And
you this has gone into an unexpected territory, hasn't it?
No, I do. And you look a bit like Mark Ruffalo. I love him.
Not many people embarrass me, but I think you might have achieved that.
The one thing I get frustrated about is, because I do have a CGM, my partner Kate has the duk, 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 duk. She does a night shift and has to sleep all day. And it's like, if I go high, her phone's beeping all day.
Oh, really?
so she gets back in her sleep. So I always unshare when it's her, you know.
Right.
It's like, but with your, you know, loved one, you're in bed, you're having a hypo, and it's like, you can't think, right? Your sugars are low, you can't think. You're like, 'cause I sweat and my brain goes, I can't think. And I'm like, sugar.
That has happened to me. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you go, sugar. And you've got sugar in your drawer. But sometimes you just need more, right? Have you had those lows where you just go to the kitchen and destroy, like, chips, lollies, cookies, because you just need to get high?
Yeah, absolutely. I still remember the first hypo I had, and it was a shudderingly bad one. I woke up at about 1:30 in the morning, utterly drenched in sweat, shaking and shivering. And for people who don't know, it's a horrible feeling, hypo,
yeah.
So when you're going too low, you start to drift, and then you start to sweat a little bit, and you shake, and it feels like you're on the cusp of of sort of passing out.
Yeah.
But it's worse than that. There's a worry there too. I don't know. It's a difficult feeling to describe. But this was my first proper one, and I ate sort of like half a packet of jelly beans and then a plate of nachos. And my daughter the next day, having heard this story, was
a
like,
wow,
what a great disease. The cure is jelly beans and nachos.
But how did you even have the energy to make nachos?
I just whacked them on a plate and ate them.
Yeah.
But after the immediate rush of sugar, I would not recommend nachos as a cure. That was on top of. But nowadays I'm quite a bit more specific and measured about how much sugar that I take when I
little blackcurrant juice and yeah, 10 Skittles or something like that.
Just having your thing, knowing how much you're going to bump yourself up by, because if you eat your way out of it, then you're up on the roller coaster and down again, and then you get into real trouble. So
I had an interview with Petra Bagist, and I told her that I was scared that I would die in my sleep because of hypos and how you can die from a hypo or pass out or go into a coma. And obviously that was a clickbait for her podcast. But the comments, because I love reading the comments. I don't get offended by people. I'm just like, okay, if you don't like me, that's fine. But people were so mean, you know, what a bloody drama queen. Oh, just show us. Oh, whatever, you know. But it is as simple as that, right? It is as simple as if you have a hypo in the night, you could go into a coma and die.
You could do, yeah, you mm-hmm. could do. And
people don't understand that.
No. I think that's what every diabetic lives with as a fear. And mm-hmm. that's why I think that we have seen such a concentrated campaign from parents to get these CGMs that we've talked about funded mm-hmm. for children, because it's a worry for you and I, but like if it was my kid, I'd just be, you know, I don't think I'd sleep without them having a CGM. You'd want to have that alarm go off, eh?
Well, otherwise you have to prick them every 2 hours to make sure their sugars are fine.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think people. We're cursed by the fact that it shares the name with type 2, but it's such a different condition.
Absolutely.
And so people don't really understand type 1 diabetes, and that's fair enough. There's a lot going on in the world, and we're only about 5% of the diabetic population, if maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. But so roughly, you know, there might be close to 300,000 type 2 diabetics in New Zealand and about maybe 20,000 type 1s. So we're about 5 to 10% of the diabetic population. But so it's not that much is known by the general public about it. I don't think they realise the amount of maintenance that goes into it. Like just rocking up for the day and just getting your stuff done with doing all that is pretty hard. And you've done it too. Like when you take on unusual jobs like Morning Report or like Morning Radio, where you're up at 4 in the morning and so many things affect blood sugar. I had a CGM on, so I knew what impact interviewing the Prime Minister had. And I used to switch it, and I went from 5 millimole
way up
to 13 or 14, mm-hmm. just on the cortisol and adrenaline release of a combative interview with the Prime Minister. And that's no food, no sugar, no anything. So that's the condition you look at. Sleep, stress, exercise, all of those things is, I don't know, 40 or 50 or more that will affect that. So you're juggling a lot of that stuff in the real world, which makes it, it's a complex thing to manage.
And the other thing is when you have a hypo, the repercussions of that is, for me personally, cloudy head and lethargy.
Yeah.
Lethargy. So I get really tired and I can't think straight. So if I'm having to do interviews, I have to, I don't know, just get on with it.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember checking my blood sugar quite a bit before live events because you're like, if my brain starts to fade here, this is not going to be good.
Have you had any moments on air where you've had low blood sugars and you've had to, you know,
just
push on?
Yep, I have. Yeah, a couple doing Morning Report. And just, I've always got sugar on me.
The team around you knows? Because I'm a team person. I'm like, everyone, I've got diabetes. Here's my sugar, here's my sugar, here's some sugar, you know? Or are you just like, quiet?
No, well, people at work around me, I'd always just injecting. Mm. I just do it. But yeah, you really do have to make sure that you don't want to slip into a hypo doing a live interview.
I know.
That's uncool.
I've had those hypos during live interviews, and it's been awful.
Yeah, because do I say anything? And you can feel you can feel yourself slowing down.
You feel yourself about to slip off the chair and pass out.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my biggest things about diabetes is because I live by myself with four children, I've had to teach my young children when to get me sugar and when to notice when I'm going low. And I feel so bad for that because they're so young and they're having to save mama all the time. So, you know, I always have a child sleeping in the bed with me who, not Marigold, because she couldn't give two shits if I'm having a hypo. She wants the lollies. She's like, give me a lolly. I'm like half dying and she's like reaching over to get the lollies. But, you know, my sons are so amazing at being able to help their mama.
I think that's really cool. And my daughter's like that too. In fact, there's no one who's more attuned to it than my daughter, who's 10 now.
Yeah.
Really attuned to it and asks about how your levels are and really, is just really engaged with that. And I think it's changed me in that respect too. I think I'm more empathetic than lots more. I think I was far more selfish. I think I'm far more able to put myself into the position of people who are vulnerable for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's changed me for the good in that sense. I'm a bit of a silver linings guy. I like to try.
You
and,
are.
Yeah, I do.
I like it.
Yeah, like I'm proud of having type 1. Like I'm probably going to get a tattoo.
Are you one of those type ones?
I don't wear a bracelet. Do you
I've
wear a bracelet?
No, yeah. I'm too rebellious to wear my bracelet.
Yeah, so I thought maybe I'd just get a tattoo or something. But I'm proud of having type 1 now.
Wait.
I'm proud of it.
So for people who don't know, we wear a medical alert bracelet saying insulin blah blah, phone number, da da da. But you want to get a tattoo. Will it be type 1?
Yeah, it's going to say...
Have someone's number?
It's going to be diabetic and then just type 1. And so if I do go down on the street, then I'm hoping that some doctor somewhere will go, oh, yeah, well, of course he's diabetic.
But I'm not getting that tattoo.
I am. Can I come and watch? Yeah.
Should I get it too?
Yeah.
But I'd have to get it on my bum because I've got nowhere else to put it.
You've got some competing space there, eh? Which is very cool, but no.
How big will it be? Like all
quite big, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think. Okay. Yeah.
I think... You ever plan to get married again? Don't get that tattoo if you want to get married again.
I think you've got it, but you know, I think you've got to see it as a positive, eh?
Well,
you just got to.
You have no choice.
Yeah.
You have literally no choice but to see as
and
a positive.
I reckon I'm healthier now than I was before I had type 1.
What about...
Because I don't drink any alcohol and I basically don't eat any sugar. Most people would recognise it as a keto diet. It's not quite because I don't go out of my way to eat fat. I just eat a lot of whole foods and avoid any sugar. And I make my own bread, make my own crackers. I'm quite into it.
Yeah.
So it's my thing now. It's like I'm diabetic. I'm not gonna, you can't argue with that. But I see it as a positive. I actually see it as a positive in my life. And I've kidded myself, but that's really important. Because if you're gonna live with something for the rest of your life, you've got to be at peace with it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're
I am
giving me
actually.
Inspiration for my brain. What about have you?
But it's been a bit longer for me.
I'm nearly
5 years in.
What about have you met other type 1 diabetics who have struggled with their mental health because of their diabetes?
Big time, everyone, everyone. In fact, I did.
Not you.
I went and saw a counsellor for sort of 4 or 5 sessions that they provided. They give that to type 1s, which was cool. So I took use of that.
I didn't get that.
You can ask for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
But I can't remember the numbers, but it was a ridiculous number, like 70 or 80% of type 1s get depression.
I've got depression.
Yeah.
Real bad depression. And I actually got it when I was diagnosed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hit you pretty hard, eh?
Yeah.
I remember seeing you in those first few months.
But I was really keen to learn from you. Hey, I was really keen.
I gave you big geek sheets, didn't I?
I know, I loved that too. And it still, to this day, helped me.
Yeah.
Helped me manage sugar intake. It was brilliant. Yeah. You were really like a lifesaver for me.
Yeah, because we had a bit in common on that, because you were running at that point too.
Yeah,
and stuff,
stopped running because I'm
hard.
Depressed.
Yeah.
I love running though. It's good for your mental health, but I will start again sometime.
Yeah. No, I've met a few type ones. I have a few type ones as friends. One guy I catch up with a bit. And it's amazing how differently people manage it and how differently their attitudes go to it. It's not many conditions where they basically say, well, you go home and you take a potentially lethal dose of this drug and you just have to set your own dose. I mean, most of it's you get a medicine and it's like, take it 3 times a day, take 20 mils. With this, it's like, well, have a hurl and see if you can guess how much insulin you need. And if you take too much, you might die. If you don't take enough over time and it's to, you know, you might go blind and get your leg cut off if you run your blood sugars too high for too long, but hey, and then it becomes so boring to you because you do it every day that you're just like, well, I don't know if you ever do this sort of rage bolus thing where you're so high, you're just trying to bring yourself down, so you're just a bit reckless and just dial it up and smash it in.
I just did that before this interview. I was 19 because I'm my what's the thing, adrenaline. For interviewing, I always go high.
So do I. Public speaking, especially if I have to speak in Te Reo Māori or something, and I'm quite nervous about it.
Yeah.
I remember checking once, I think I was doing something here actually, it was a mihi whakatau or something like that, and I checked and I was really quite nervous about it, and I looked and I was like 16 or 17, and I'd eaten nothing. And that's the cruel thing for diabetics, is where you're actually really hungry, but you're really high, so you can't eat anything.
You have to drink water and go for
a walk. It's like, great, you know, that's when sometimes I'm like, if I hadn't made that pact for myself, I'd start feeling a bit sorry for myself now.
You can break your pact.
Yeah.
It's only a pact.
Yeah.
Nothing's forever. Nothing lasts forever.
Well, type 1 does.
Oh, Okay, let's stop talking about diabetes. God, it's such a dumb name too, diabetes. It's diabetes.
It is a dumb name.
Yeah, diabetes.
I call myself a T1.
Well, you're going to have it on your arm soon, aren't you?
Yeah.
Two more things. Do you believe in love at first sight?
I kind of do. Yeah. I'll extrapolate on this a little bit. I do think the connection thing is really quick and really real, you know? Like that bit where you meet someone and you look at them. That there's something that happens there, eh? There's a, and it must be something quite deep in our brains, but I think that whether that's going to turn into a long-lasting, sustainable, healthy relationship, who knows? But the whole connection thing is there pretty immediately, don't you reckon?
I fully agree. Do you believe in soulmates then? You're such a thinker. Because I'm like,
No, I don't think I do.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. This is a bit deep for a last question, but do we have a soul? Where is it?
Oh, you went there.
Where is it?
Well, it's in our heart, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I lost mine with my pancreas.
Don't say that. Do you believe in spirits and ghosts and, like, when you're dead, but where's all that energy going?
I think it lives on in the minds of the people that you connected with.
Yeah,
I'm not a ghosts guy.
Of course you're not.
I'm not an afterworld guy.
No.
I'm an atheist, and I'm proud to say that.
I can feel that from you.
Yeah. But I think...
So you refuse spirits into your house?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like literally spirits and spirits.
Yeah. I was never much of a spirits guy. I do remember, well, I still did drink through my first year of diabetes. And I worked out with the CGM that beer pushed up your blood sugars, especially the craft beer that I liked.
Yep.
Wine kept them stable and spirits drops them. And I remember one particular night trying to manage my blood sugar levels with beer, wines and spirits. It was a pretty bloody stupid thing to do.
It would have been,
but I was only like 48, you know, okay, cut me a break.
Thanks so much for listening to It's Personal with me, Anika Moa. A huge thank you to my guest guy on Espina for sharing with me today. Also to the team that helps make this happen, Charlotte Purdy and Vanessa Hawken from Rogue Productions, Tim Watkin and Liz Garten from RNZ, and our audio engineers Blair Stagpole and Adrian Holley. Cole Easton Farrelly is the video editor, and thanks to Jane Joyce for graphics and Brianna Juritich for production support. It's Personal with Anika Moore is available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Don't forget to follow so you don't miss an episode.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.